Dark Side of the Ring this week was the story of Ion Krotoro, better known in the wrestling world as Johnny K-9 or Bruiser Bedlam in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, if you were a Smoky Mountain fan. I came into the episode not knowing a lot about him beyond the fact that he had fallen into this life of crime and he ended up going to prison. I remember hearing a lot about that when he passed away a few years ago. But I came into this not knowing much about him beyond that. And these are the episodes I feel like I like the most because I learn a lot of things that I didn't know going into it. And it's not just rehashing things that I did know. He did jobs for WWE in the 80s, around the time that I first became a fan and started watching, and I have no memory of Johnny K-9 at all. That's a name I think that you would remember if you heard it. Yeah, I think of Barry Horowitz, Mike Sharp, Steve Lombardi, Dwayne Gill. Those are some of the job guys that I watched the most. I don't remember Johnny K-9. But his life of crime started early, and his widow Tracy, who was the main talking head interviewed for the episode, because she obviously would have known him the most, said that he had already been to prison before the two of them even met in the early 90s. She was an exotic dancer, and he walked into the bar that she was working in, and it was love at first sight. And when his WWF work dried up, that's when he met Scott D'Amore for the first time, who was, you know, working as an independent wrestler. And now Scott D'Amore works for Impact Wrestling. But he was one of Johnny's best friends, and they travel the road together, and they work together, and he told a great story about being stiffed on his pay one night by a promoter. And they get in the car as they left the building, and when Johnny finds out that, you know, D'Amore was shorted on the money, he storms back into the arena, he grabs the promoter by the throat, and he threatens him until he paid D'Amore the money that he was owed. Which, as D'Amore told him after the fact, wasn't the wisest move because the promoter never booked them again after that. You know, Nails grabbed Vince McMahon by the throat many years ago, and he never got booked again either by Vince. The lesson here is don't try to strangle your boss, no matter how much you might want to do it. But he was the life of the party, this guy. You listen to D'Amore, you listen to Lance Storm, who was another friend of Johnny's, Jim Cornette, who brought him into Smoky Mountain because the moment he saw this guy wrestling at an independent show, this big, scary-looking 300-pound, you know, mountain of a man, he knew that he could make money with him. And apparently, everybody loved him. Cornette said for the 9 months that he had him, he doesn't remember a single incident, a single time that he caused problems or was a headache in the locker room, nothing. He was a model citizen. Which is why it's so hard for them to reconcile that this is the same man who would later on be accused of murder and of blowing up a police station. Cornette didn't like the name Johnny K-9. He gave him the name Bruiser Bedlam. On his very first night in, Cornette had him go over on Bullet Bob Armstrong, who is a legend. You did not beat Bob Armstrong back then, but Bruiser Bedlam did, and he did it in his debut. So right away, he had instant credibility with the audience. You know, it's kind of similar to the way that Vader debuted in New Japan when he beat Inoki. They were trying to create a monster. Bill Dunphy is a retired journalist they interviewed who explained that Johnny grew up mostly poor. And when he didn't make much money in wrestling, the amount of money that he had hoped, he started working as a debt collector for a certain well-known crime family. His wife said that he would come home sometimes, he would have blood on his hands, he'd have blood on his shoes. Just another day at the office, I guess. But they talked about him hooking up with the Satan's Choice motorcycle gang, and he started his own chapter up in Hamilton, Ontario. Nobody worked their way up the ranks faster than this guy did. I mean, there were times they said where he would be making 20 to 30 grand in a matter of minutes. I'm sure all of that was on the up and up. But if he got a call, let's say, to go work a wrestling show 6 hours away for $200, he'd drop everything, pile in his car, and he would drive off and go do it because he had a love for pro wrestling. He badly wanted to make it. And so even though he was doing all this other stuff and illegally making all of this other money, hand over fist, he had no issues or qualms about going to work, you know, for some promoter somewhere, making $150, probably losing money. He probably paid more money on gas than he would actually be paid by the promoter just to get there and back. But I love the part where Cornette talked about booking a main event in Smoky Mountain between Randy Savage and Bruiser Bedlam in 94. This is when WWE would send talent there occasionally. Cornette was working for them, and so, you know, Vince would throw some talent his way. And it was Savage's idea to put Bruiser over because, as Savage explained to Cornette, I'm only in for this one show. And Bruiser, he's your guy. So he should be the one to go over. And they had footage of the match with Bruiser pinning the Macho Man. It was the biggest win of his career. After that, it was all downhill. But I thought that was cool. It kind of reminded me of the stories that DDP tells. You know, and when we talked on the podcast, when I had DDP on, I think it was the first interview I did with him. He shared a lot of Randy Savage stories. He's talked very fondly of Randy Savage and what Savage did for him and how he put him over and really put him on the map in WCW as a main eventer. So this is not the first time I've heard this type of story about Randy Savage. You don't hear stories like that a lot about the really top senior most guy. I mean, you'll hear some stories like that, but I always think it's very cool when I hear something like that. But Lance Storm was really good here in this episode as somebody who knew the positive side of this man, but he also admitted that, you know, when he talks about thinking that only, you know, if only his wrestling career had taken off, maybe it would have taken him away from all the bad stuff that he was involved with. He admitted, though, he goes, it could just be that this is my own way of trying to make him the person that I wanted him to be. You know, he's very realistic about things. All the news stories and the charges against him. You can't deny that this guy was involved in a lot of really bad shit. And he doesn't try to rationalize it away, but he's explaining that as a friend of his, it's hard for him to just wrap his mind around the fact that this guy did these things. He even did a portion of what he's accused of and what he went to jail for. And he says it could just be that this is my coping mechanism. It's my way of just trying to, in my mind, rationalize things, even though that may not be the reality of the situation. It's not often that we get to see super serious Lance Storm break and show emotion the way he did here. He started tearing up and crying and getting emotional there at the end. It was powerful stuff, but it was also really sad. The wildest story, and I mentioned the bombing, and that was the wildest story in the episode, is Johnny's chapter, the chapter of the gang, you know, that he started. His chapter making nice with another chapter and a guy named Michael, who is really a bad dude. One night, they decide to go to a strip club called the Solid Gold. So all these guys from each of these chapters pull up on their motorcycles. And I guess the rule in the club is that if you're a gang member, if you're a biker, whatever, you don't wear your colors. That's not allowed in the establishment. I think it was actually Johnny, they said in the episode, who spoke up and said, wait, what are you talking about? They go, yeah, we can't wear our colors in there or they're going to kick us out. And he's like, fuck that. You know, because he was proud. Well, they all go in and they get kicked out because they're not allowed to wear their colors in the club. They're not welcome there. So there's a big standoff. The cops are called. They have a big standoff with the police. The gang members back down. Johnny and Michael, they're not happy about all of this. And so they hatch a plan to bomb the Solid Gold. Because that's a perfectly rational reaction to have when you are kicked out of a club. Michael, though, apparently without Johnny's knowledge, and they talked about there being a wiretap and being able to hear, you know, Johnny K-9 and how, you know, surprised he was that the plan changed, the old plans change, Michael decided it would be better to bomb the police station instead of the Solid Gold. And they planted the bomb in the alley next door. It goes off. It rips a hole in the wall of the police station. Yeah, they had a, you know, again, they had a lot of property damage and stuff, and I think there were some injuries. I don't recall if they mentioned anybody was killed. I don't believe there were any fatalities in that. But still, they bombed a fucking police station, you know? I mean, you gotta be a crazy SOB to talk about bombing a police station. Now, mind you, even though Johnny may not have wanted to bomb a police station, he still was going to bomb a building. It's just that the building they bombed was not the one that he had intended. So the cops got them later for the bombing, and they got them on extortion charges, drug charges. He talks to the police, does Johnny, and he names Michael as the mastermind of the entire thing. And that does not go over too well with the other members of the gang, because you don't rat people out, right? What do they say? Snitches get stitches. You don't rat people out. They looked at him as a rat, and they kicked him out. So he served 33 months in prison for the bombing. But after he was released, he ended up right back behind bars for after being charged for the double murder of a lawyer and her husband that happened a few years earlier in 1998. Those charges, later on, they got dropped due to insufficient evidence. His wife insists, oh, he never killed anybody. But, I mean, you would expect his wife to stick by him and say something like that. I mean, put yourself in her position. She obviously, the one thing you get from listening to her, even though they had their issues, and at one point, you know, when he was behind bars, she, you know, took the kid and fled, and they ended up back together again. It was kind of a volatile relationship, but she clearly loved him. There was clearly a love, a bond shared between these two people. So I'm sure she doesn't want to believe in her mind that this person that she loved and called her husband and shared a home with could be a cold-blooded killer. So she insists, didn't kill anybody. The cops still believe that he was the guilty party. They just didn't have enough evidence for it to hold up in court. He joined another gang later on called the United Nations, and was arrested again. This time he was one of 8 people charged with conspiracy to commit murder for plotting to kill members of a rival gang. It was a botched hit. It led to the death of an innocent person. He later told the parole board when he was up for parole years later that he only went along with the other members to try to impress them, and he never actually intended to kill anyone. Of course, I would say the same thing if I were up for parole. I would tell them exactly what I thought they would want to hear. And his parole was denied, and in 2017, he died, living in a halfway house, allegedly due to a heart attack. That's per the police. There's another person, former gang member of his, you know, with him, who says that somebody gave him a hot shot, and the drugs are what killed him. His wife says the guards maced him, they had to scrape his lungs. You know, at the time of his death, this wasn't mentioned in the episode, but at the time of his death, his wife said that he was suffering from some type of respiratory ailment and was complaining about that. You know, all these different excuses. Maybe it was Colonel Mustard with the candlestick in the dining room. Who the hell knows? The point is, he died, and he was only 53 years old at the time of his death. That double murder remains unsolved. And, you know, he's a complicated guy when you listen to all of the testimonials from the people who knew him and worked with him. They can't believe that it was the same person who did all of those other things, but he clearly did some bad shit and hung around with a lot of really bad people. He's no hero in this story. Johnny K-9 is no hero. And maybe Lance Storm is right. Maybe if he had struck it big in pro wrestling, it would have kept him away from all the other, you know, gang-related stuff that he did later in his life. Or maybe he was just drawn to it. I mean, the man spent so much time behind bars, he could have been a bartender. Some people just can't help themselves. It's part of their DNA. It's part of who they are. And his wife talked about living at home. He had a very his father was very abusive to him and his mother. And that has an impact on you too. And maybe, you know, from a very young age, maybe he was predisposed to violence and that type of stuff. later on in his life. So who's to say even if he became a not even a big star, but just, you know, a moderately well-known name in wrestling and a champion, maybe he had a higher profile career in WWF or WCW, who's to say he still wouldn't have been doing all this other stuff on the side? Or when his run came to an end, he wouldn't have ended up in it anyway. You know, in a lot of ways, his story reminds me in that way of the Dino Bravo story, which we heard about on Dark Side of the Ring previously. You know, in the case of Bravo, he had the wrestling career. He was very successful even before coming to WWF. You know, in WWF, he was kind of mid to upper mid card. But he had a lot of success in wrestling. And when that was over and that fizzled out, he had family connections to organized crime. He got involved in that. And that ultimately is what led to his downfall. He went down a bad road and he paid the price for it. When you hang out with people like that, bad things are going to happen. And it's very similar to the Johnny Canine story when you hear about it. That's kind of what it reminded me of. But he's an interesting character. And I learned about him here, more about him here than I knew coming into this, which I always appreciate. This week's episode coming up is The Many Faces of Luna Vachon, which I am very much looking forward to. I had the great pleasure of meeting Luna twice, once in 94, once in 98. Both times she was a total sweetheart, the complete opposite of what you saw on TV. And she died far too young. And I'll have a review up for that next week. So until then, be well, stay safe, and I will see you back here for more Dark Side of the Ring reviews very soon. Take care, guys.